are tuned in to Community Radio, WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Welcome to the Audio Garden, where we cultivate our collective wisdom, nurture creativity, and spread love. My name is Martha Senator, and this is Listen and Be Heard.
Listen and be heard, because I have a story to tell, as you have a story to tell. We are individuals, our stories will be different, and it's important that all voices be heard. As we are challenged by the differentness in cultures, in populations, in class, financial status, the more voices we can hear, the more the people become accustomed to listening, even with points of view that they may not agree with. I believe that that is a shorter path to acceptance.
And now, years later, I cater to my budding intuition, the condition of my gut, if I'm in a rut, sinking or swimming.
Like, it's a, gosh, I said, my man has a trilogy. Because whenever I think of trilogy, you know, I'm thinking Ali Frazier, Graziano Zale, Ward Gotti. You know, I'm thinking, you know, like in threes, right? And I say, oh, my man here, you know, he fought, man. And he has his own three. So, hey.
That's awesome. I love that.
I come from the cold. My old spirit split between north and northern, east and easter, and Passover and passed over. Thanks for everything.
Well, when
that
I listen
real,
and be heard, I find my cosmic film interest expands into an ecstatic dream.
I'm here. That's
the way I live my life inside that dream.
Instill me
moving
with
from
grace,
ecstasy to
grace
serenity,
me
my
with
dualistic,
faith me
life.
With my story. Tell me.
Welcome back to the Audio Garden, my friends. It's so good to be here with you, as always. I'm grateful to be your guide down the pathways of this very special place. And I'm glad to be joined this week by my good friend and co-host, Tony Robles, who will welcome author Joe Seipel to the Audio Garden. Later in the hour, we'll have new music brought to us by Hernan Ramiro. But right now, we're going to go to a poem read to us by Judy Tologan and written by Mary Tall Mountain.
Mary Tall Mountain was a poet and storyteller, mixed Scotch-Irish, you know, and Koyukon, from Yukon ancestry. This is Prayer Wheel for William. You worked alongside men riding the fish wheel down the fixture tides of summer, your boy hands hurrying, baskets tossing, splashing salmon onto the birchwood raft. Your cut-up, wind-burned hands that loved the violin smelling of fish and the wood smoke, tall and awkward Indian boy, arms too long, hair always falling into your blackberry eyes, drifting with the river, turning with the fish wheel. My prayers of you are turning.
This is the Listen and Be Heard Hour. Thank you, Judy Tologan, for reading that poem by Mary Tall Mountain. And we'll go now to Tony Robles.
This is Tony Robles. Our guest today is the author of a wonderful book called The First Wish of Mr. Murray McBride. Joe, welcome to the Audio Garden.
Thank you very much.
Murray McBride is an octogenarian with a fixation on SUVs, which immediately piqued my interest. You're a television sportscaster turned novelist. How did you become interested in writing novels And were you setting out initially to write a trilogy?
It was kind of an interesting way I got into it. And I think it's a little different from a lot of writers who know from a very early age that they want to write, or they've always been big book people. I was kind of your stereotypical jock when I was growing up, a kid out playing outside all day long. And then in high school and college, I was playing sports. And so really not on my radar to become a writer. And then one day, I can tell you exactly when it happened. My wife was my girlfriend at the time, and she was in medical school. And so she was studying all the time, and I had nothing to do when I would go and visit her. And so one day, I really have no idea where it came from, but I just felt like I had this idea that I wanted to write down. And so I went to the computer in the corner of the room, and I started writing this story that over the course of the next few months became a book-length manuscript. It was terrible. It was not well done at all, because I was really kind of starting from scratch, because I didn't have that background of a writer. So it took me a long time to polish my craft and learn how to not only write, but how to write fiction. First of all, I had a journalism degree from college, and so I kind of had to unlearn how to write like a journalist, learn how to write like a novelist, but then also to figure out what kind of writer I am and what I enjoy writing, because I would try everything when I first started. I just knew that I really liked crafting stories and wanted to be an author. And so I tried everything I could think of, and I finally landed on what really is my kind of story, which unfortunately doesn't really have a easily classified genre. And I think that's been another reason why it took so long to get published. But really, the way I think of it is I like to write stories that have an emotional impact on readers. I think that's what makes reading a book worthwhile. And that is about something that matters to me. And the way that started, I wrote about this old man who meets a young boy with a terminal heart defect, a list of 5 things he wants to do before he dies. And the old man takes the young boy under his wing, and they set off to check off as many wishes as they can. And that was kind of the structure of the story. But I hit a roadblock and then didn't really know what to do with it. And so I put it aside for a while. And during that time, my dad died unexpectedly, and he and I were very close. And it was the first time that I lost somebody really close to me like that. And when I went back to the story, I was a different person, really. And I came back to it with a different perspective, and really was working through my own grief at that point. And so I hate to even call it a silver lining or anything like that, but it losing my dad really helped me figure out who I was as a writer.
You had touched on the fact that you have a journalism background. Were you writing sport?
I was not covering hard-hitting news. I was covering sports, but then I was on TV. So I wasn't even writing, you know, sports copy for newspapers or anything. I would just go out and shoot highlights of pretty small markets. So a lot of high school sports in the area, but then also close enough to Minneapolis at the time that I would go and cover all the Minnesota professional sports teams, and then come back and do the highlights at the 6 and 10 o'clock news. I was a reporter anchor for about 5 years in Minnesota. It was really more fun, and, you know, covering stories where it wasn't a lot of drama or hard hitting things. It was, you know, trying to make the kids look good. You know, they were excited about being able to be on TV on their local station. It was something people enjoyed, and that was the point of it.
You do have the elements of storytelling, of a character, of plot, of action, keeping the action going, introducing elements of, you know, dramatic elements that are all requisites of the field. It just made me think of Richard Hugo, who was a poet. He wrote a lot about the poetic approach in prose. And he said about journalism that oftentimes we're just inundated with a lot of facts.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no connection with the facts. Whereas if we can divorce ourselves from so many facts, then we can deal more in language.
That's beautiful. And I think that's kind of what I was hinting at when I said I had to unlearn how to write like a journalist, because it's very much from point A to point B, and be as clear and concise as you can. And it's very different from the meandering character building, you know, world building you do in a novel. To your point, I hadn't really thought of it like this before, but I think it's a really good point that the storytelling element that I did have in my journalism wasn't in the times where I would go and shoot highlights and then bring the highlights back. It was when I was sent out on assignment to do a story about a kid with a special situation or you know, in the sports world, it was never, again, that really hard-hitting story, but it did give me a lot of opportunity for creativity and get to know the kid and what makes him different and what angle should I be using for this story. And then how do you make it more than just point A to point B in the storytelling, but actually develop a sense of finding ways that the audience might be intrigued by what they're hearing. And so I do think that I had some practice of storytelling in that realm. But overall, it was something that was, like you were saying, with just information. And that's really how you're taught in journalism, because The point is to help people understand, not to give them an experience, right? The point of writing a novel is to give the reader an experience. So it's a very different kind of writing. And it took me a long time. It was 17 years from that day I sat down in my wife's apartment, or my girlfriend at the time, to the day my first published novel came out. It was 17 years. It was a lot of failure and a lot of rejection. And so it's been interesting now with the books kind of taken off. I don't take any of it for granted, because I had to go through all of that failure and rejection. And I'm just super grateful for everything that's happening. And I like to think that I would still have that gratitude had it happened quickly and easily. But I'm convinced that I have another level of gratitude for everything because of the way it all went down.
Murray is a very likable character. And in some ways, he's living in a world that's much different than what he's used to, and he's had to adjust. And he and his wife, in the particular story, The First Wish of Mr. Murray McBride, they've outlived their peers. I mean, he's an octogenarian. I think his wife is 1 year older than he is.
And yeah, correct.
They're going back and forth between 1910 and the present. I wanted to ask you, you know, were the characters based on any specific person, or perhaps maybe a composite of different people that you've met in the past? Because we have Murray, we have his wife, and then we have a character from the past. I think it was the wife's sister who had polio. And
so there was never a really direct connection in my mind where, like, this person that I knew was this character in the story. There was never anything that direct. But I think that there is, you know, just something that happens with any author, is their own life experiences come out on the page and in their characters. And so you kind of can't help that. You're limited by your own imagination, and your own imagination is somewhat limited by your own experience. And so certainly people that I've met come out in my characters. The way I think that that happens most concretely is in my young female characters, because I have two daughters. And as I've been working on this writing endeavor for the last, you know, 24 years now, 25 years, they were born and grew up, and now they're both in college. And so it is kind of funny when I look back at the stories that I've written, oftentimes I have a young female character that does grow with my daughters as they were growing. And I think a big part of that is just that was the kind of person I felt like I could understand at a level to be able to write them all authentically. The old adage, you know, write what you know, it's hard to write something if you don't know much about it. That was kind of a shortcut for me to be able to write characters that I knew would be authentic to that age, because I was taking care of those little girls in my real life. I mentioned my wife was in medical school back when I started writing. She was family medicine doctor for the past, you know, 16 years or so, and I was a stay-at-home dad. I was with my daughters all the time and really, you know, got to have a wonderful relationship with them. And
you have a situation in the beginning where there's a ceremony with Murray and
Jenny, yep.
Wife, and Jenny, who've been married with 80 some years.
Yeah, yeah.
And Murray is telling her how much she's meant to him, and they're surrounded by a lot of people who aren't their age because they've outlived everybody. You know, Jenny looks up at Murray and says, "And who are you?" So we're dealing with a story that is dealing with dementia or Alzheimer's, which is really one of the big issues in the book. Can you talk about that? Because a lot of people are dealing with that, with relatives.
Yeah, that was obviously one of the main themes of the story. And I wanted to handle it as delicately as I could, because it's something where, like you said, a lot of people are dealing with this, and a lot of them have very different experiences. It's not a one-size-fits-all type thing. And when I'm writing about sensitive topics like this, my greatest fear is that I write something that offends somebody, or even just to make them feel like, oh, he's not handling the topic right. And I want to avoid that. So I took a lot of steps, and there's a local organization called Dementia Together, and I met with the woman who is in charge of that, and she put me in touch with several elderly men who are caring for their wives who are with dementia right now. And so I was able to get a lot of different perspectives. One of the things that several of them said is, you know, don't just make it another tragedy. So much of what they see about dementia and Alzheimer's in the media and in stories is just a tragedy. And in a way that, you know, somewhat unavoidable, because it only goes one way, right? It's not something that people recover from, but it is something they can live with. Right? And that's, I think, the point they wanted me to get across, is that they're still people. They're still, even though they're not able to do the things cognitively that they used to be able to do, they are still people deserving of love and respect. And they wanted that to come out in the story.
This is the Listen and Be Heard Hour.
Recalling those feelings brings on a glimmer of hope. I used to feel hope all the time, back in my charmed youth. That sense that anything's possible. Not only possible, but virtually assured. The knowledge, deep down, that things will work out. Thinking about that kid, I feel that old spark of hope for the first time in years. The spark of possibility. And I can't stop the thought that at least in some way, everything on this list could happen for him. I decide right here and now that I'm going to make sure they do. I'm going to take that pill after all and stick around for a while. In fact, I'll be damned if that boy doesn't get each and every one of those wishes before he dies. They're not just his wishes now, they're mine too. If I wasn't stuck in this beanbag, I'd find a phone and call up Doc Keaton right now to tell him the good news. His favorite 100-year-old has found a reason to live. Murray McBride, it sounds kind of silly to say, but he's changed my life. The first time I got a book published and it did well, and now I can write full time, and so I feel so indebted to this fictional character. When we meet him in The First Wish, I wrote that book after the other two books in the series, which is The Five Wishes of Mr. Murray McBride and The Final Wish of Mr. Murray McBride. And so I knew the character so well at that point that it was so easy to write that part of the story. And it was a fun thing to write because, you know, if you read the rest of the series, which happens after Jenny has died, he's very lost and bitter and kind of a grumpy old man at that point until he meets this young boy that turns his life around. In the first one, he's with the love of his life, right? And so even though he's having this very challenging situation of having to deal with her living with dementia, Murray with Jenny is a different Murray than without. And it was really fun to be able to write his character with this woman that he's been in love with for 8 years.
The sense of agency as well, not only in their advanced age, but also going back to 1910. He has a sister that's dealing with polio, and they have this wish, this secret, this buried treasure that they're trying to get at. And there's no quit in this girl, even though, you know, she's going through polio and all these different things. So you have a sense of agency that transcends time. What's been the reaction to the book from people that perhaps are dealing with a loved one with this?
It's been pretty universally positive. I guess the thing that proves that to me is the woman who is in charge of the organization. After she read it, she ordered 50 copies to be able to give to the people that she's working with. And that kind of speaks volumes to what she thought about it. And I was scared about that, to be honest, because I want to be able to write stories that touch people on a deep emotional level. Feeling powerful emotions is what makes us human, right? I mean, if you talk about somebody who's going through depression or something, a lot of times they feel like they're just not feeling anything. You know, they're just kind of blah. The opposite of that is feeling things strongly. And I know that there are things that in real life, people would probably rather not have to feel strongly. Obviously, if you lose somebody you love, it'd rather not have to feel that. Fiction is a great avenue to be able to feel these strong emotions within the safety of a story. There's a reason why people like books and movies that make them cry. You would think, well, why do you want to cry? That's a sad thing. Why would you want to do that? But there's some sort of release to that. There's some sort of experience of feeling a powerful emotion. And when you can have that within the safety of the story and not have to have it be because of an actual tragedy in your life, I feel like there's value to that. And so that's what I'm always striving for, is to give a reader that experience, because that's the kind of experience I like as a reader. If I can pull it off to where it feels authentic and real and deep in some way, then I think I've succeeded in what I'm trying to do as a writer.
What message do you have for younger people? I was just really just taken by, you know, you have a younger character in the book. There's kind of a subplot where, you know, she's getting evicted. There's a struggle there, and Murray has to kind of negotiate between his feelings of community and care for that mother and daughter, and yet juggle, you know, what's happening with his wife in real time.
The thing that I hope young people take from my book more than anything else is that we need to value the wisdom of the elderly. And that's something that in our culture, we just don't do very much. We have people get to a certain age where we decide that they're not able to help in our capitalistic society, and they're not going to be making money. They're not really doing anything tangible that we can see anymore. And so therefore they don't have value anymore. There's a lot of cultures around the world that are a little smarter about that than we are, I think, where the elders in the community have a place of prominence and their wisdom is valued. And I think, you know, a lot of times I've got several friends I talk to, just being men who are, you know, now we're not, you know, as young as we used to be, but being a young man that without the village elder kind of a idea, right? Without the sage a wise man to be able to pass down his wisdom. And I was lucky enough to have a great father, and he taught me so many things about how to live a good life. And I was very beneficial in that way. But even when you have that, I think there's benefit to accessing the wisdom of the collective elders in a community. And I think that we don't do that enough. And my wife right now is setting a really good example that I need to try to follow. She just stopped practicing medicine recently, and she's doing more things that she feels is actually making a bigger difference. And so she's volunteering at a hospice organization here in town. She just met with a patient yesterday. She was just talking about how this woman had so many amazing stories and wise things to say. And people don't hear that in our culture very often because we kind of disregard people when they get older. I think sometimes we're scared for some reason. We think it would be uncomfortable or strange, or we don't know how it would go if we talked with them. But having a conversation with somebody much older than you can be a really eye-opening and enlightening thing.
Murray was just one of these characters that I stayed with. I couldn't really put the book down because I wanted to know what was going to happen. We were bouncing between the modern day, going back to 1910, folks that were dealing with consumption or, tuberculosis, and Murray had, come through all that with his wife. The affection, that he had for, and the love that he had for his wife, just a character that kind of moved through the world with a sense of agency and a sense of grace in spite of the severity of the situation. We have folks that listen to our program that are writing their own work. They're trying to negotiate, how to get an agent, the feasibility of whether this thing is going to sell.
Yeah, it's so hard. And what I always tell people when I talk about that is you have to want to write, not just want to have written. And there's a huge difference there. Some people, I was one of them too, just wanted to have my book on the bookshelf and have success. Like, what you do in life is you try to be successful at whatever you're doing. But that is probably not enough for most people because it is a hard thing to break in and to get an agent and to get a publisher to accept your work, and then to have it sell. Like, there's just so many things that have to go well. And I always tell the story of that 17 years, the abbreviated version is, I would write a manuscript pretty much every year. And then I would query between 75 and 100 literary agents every year. So I was rejected about 1,000 times before I ended up getting published. And a lot of people will ask, why didn't you quit? My answer is twofold. One is I tried, but it turned out I'm not very good at quitting. I really liked writing. And so every time I would quit, I would then, a week later, I would have an idea for a story I just had to write. And so I would start again. But the other thing, my dad taught me something what I've come to talk to or refer to as the never going to get there lesson. And what it was is he'd come home from work at about 5 o'clock, and we'd go in the backyard and we'd play catch with a baseball. And after a while, we wanted to make it a little more fun. So we'd start throwing me pop-ups. And then once I got to where I could catch pop-ups, he'd throw me a pop-up that was a little farther away. So I had to run for it. And I'd catch that. And so he'd throw one farther away and farther away. And then finally he'd throw one really far away. And he'd say, never going to get there. But once in a while, I would actually make a nice running, diving catch and get there and make the catch. And over in my childhood, this would happen where he'd throw one really far away, say, never going to get there. And most of the time I didn't. But occasionally I did. And over time, I came to understand that that phrase, never going to get there, didn't actually mean I was never going to get there. It meant I had a chance to get there. I just had to work a little bit harder. And so it really was something that made its way into my bones and in all aspects of my life. I was very fortunate. And then I didn't have that kind of negative self-talk that so many people have of that voice saying, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. Even though I was being told that over and over and over with these rejections, I had this other voice in my head that my dad had fostered that thought, well, maybe I can if I just keep working. And eventually I got lucky. I think that maybe part of it is through perseverance and hard work, you can make some of your own luck. But still, there's no guarantee that the Murray McBride books were going to catch on like they have. And that's why I'm so grateful that I'm in the situation that I am now. Is it's really nice to be able to show my daughters that hard work and perseverance can pay off and kind of continue that legacy that my dad started.
Never going to get there. You not only got there, but you got there 3 times. And then some. The 5 wishes of Mr. Murray McBride. The final wish of Mr. Murray McBride. And the latest, which is the one that I read, of course, the first wish of Mr. Murray McBride by Joe Sipel. It's Joe, last name is S-I-P-E-L. MCLE, the Murray McBride trilogy. I would highly recommend that. As far as the website and ways that people can get in touch or learn more about your work, how can they do that?
Yeah, the website is joestiplebooks.com. So joestiplebooks.com. And that's the best way to contact me. I'm still at the point where I'm able to respond to every reader that contacts me through the website. And it'll be me personally responding to that. It means a lot to me to be able to engage with readers, because it's anybody who takes their time out of the day, who's impacted enough by one of my stories to contact me, they deserve to have some one-on-one interaction. And so I'm on to make sure to give that to them, and just the contact Joe button, and I'm on the other side of it.
JoeSipleBooks.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. Right on. And this is Listen and Be Heard Radio. Thank you, Joe Siple, for being with us today.
Once it's heard, it can't be unheard. Once it's published, it's not going to be unpublished. Once you read the poem, you can't unread it. No matter how an individual may try to push it to the side, forget about it, it's still in there. And it's the words, the meaning, the feelings behind it are taking root in their psyche, and they can't get rid of it.
There's been a lot of uproar in Ohio about anti-intellectualism, about the freedom of education, about DEI and race-based centers and gender-based centers being closed down at campuses. I think I'm more close to this because of my PhD. So I am more involved in just trying to navigate these new structures. I think that's what I've seen other folks.
Listen and be heard.
A lot of what do we say instead of DEI?
Yeah,
do we say accessibility now?
It's a validation of existence, I guess.
I'm trying to still do the work.
Good enough.
I mean, listen and be heard. Don't be spoken over.
Gender gentrification, affections, redactions, interactive, transacting, actionable, acting out.
Listen and be heard. Hearkening to oneself, to all that is. We hear that voice, connect with something that is in us and beyond us, and find that the deeper that we listen, the more it is our voice that we're hearing.
It's fine to keep your candle burning when the wind blows and yours is the only flame you see, which can't be. Can it be? It bees what bees, and you see what you see. And when they say it's me and point their fingers to a page in a book, a prescription on a page that says, my rage is a disorder of my brain. My pain is a disorder from the order, a border on revolutionary thoughts about how it ought to be, where we are free to walk the land and work in community and drink clean water and share recipes for health and feed the spirit and celebrate life loud enough for the ancestors to hear and the darkness to know fear.
This is the Listen and Be Heard Hour, brought to you by the Listen and Be Heard Network, which is a project of Sound System Culture, Inc. My name is Martha Senator, and I'm very happy to be your guide in the audio garden. And I want to thank my co-host, Tony Robles, and author Joe Siple for joining us here in the first half of the show. All of our shows are archived at listenandbeheard.net, where you can also go to support this commercial-free podcast and community radio show. We would greatly appreciate any donations that you would like to make to the cost of producing this show for you weekly. Coming up, new music presented to us by my co-producer and colleague and co-host and the artistic director of Sound System Culture, Hernan Ramiro, formerly known as J. Rodriguez Sierra. Please stick around and listen to the sounds of the Audio Garden, and he'll meet you on the other side of the bridge in about a minute.
What's up? It's Hernan Ramiro Rodriguez Sierra here for Listen and Be Heard. I'm looking forward to playing this music for you guys. This is going to be really great. We have a really great special show for you. We're going to feature a live piece of mine called Marzo, recorded a while ago, featuring Verona Clough, Pete Drungle, Lonnie Plaxico on bass, and myself, Lute, and special guest Chris DeBurge and his two sons, Misha DeBurge and Andrew DeBurge on Bata. And I hope you enjoy that. It's called Marzo, or March. Right after that, I've got a really, really, really great treat for you guys. A couple of weeks ago, I was a guest of Mitch Goldman for his show, Deep Focus, on WKCR. We focused on Jim Pepper, an amazing Native American saxophonist and jazz artist who I had the pleasure of studying with on and off when I was a teenager here in New York City. His name is Jim Pepper. If you don't know who he is, you should really check him out. One of the few great Native American jazz artists of our times, an amazing human being and master saxophone. He influenced Michael Brecker, one of the great. Mitch Goldman had asked me to think of some artists that we'd like go into a deep focus on, and we chose to have Jim Pepper. And we spoke about Jim Pepper and found some unreleased recordings of him from 1981 with Don Cherry and some with Paul Motion. But the ones I'm going to play for you only here at Listen and Be Heard Hour for Readers and Writers, these are two amazing works. They're both live recordings. The first one is called Custer Gets It. You can believe it. And it features Don Cherry, trumpet vocals, doing his thing, man. And Jim Pepper on saxophone and vocals. Rick Cherry on piano and Siggy Kratz on bass guitar. And Kamet Hank Drake on drums. All right. And that's from January 15th, 1981. Don Cherry and Jim Pepper Quintet. And we're going to end with Jim Pepper's well-known work, Wichitaito, beautiful chant. And Wichitaito, by the way, is a traditional peyote chant from the Native American ceremonial music. It is a sacred language, it's phonetic, and it's meant to carry deep spiritual power rather than any sort of semantic meaning. Jim Pepper was Kaw from Kansas and Creek, and he had learned it from his grandfather. All right, hope you enjoy it. Check it out. Thank you.
The old days for when die, and I want no hope. Your days for when die, and I want no hope. Your days for when die, and I want no hope. Yana ne, ne, no way.
Listen and Be Heard Hour, brought to you by the Listen and Be Heard Network, which also brings you a bi-weekly program called Beyond Borders, which is co-produced by Judy Tulogin and Hernan Ramiro and myself, Martha Senator. And in this next little segment, we're going to bring you some poetry by Suzette Clark Bradshaw and a little bit of sound from our current episode of Beyond Borders, available at listenandbeheard.net, as well as a little bit from Shalmia Chaudhry, who will be my guest next week in the audio garden.
Raindrop. The storm comes in quickly. The wind whips, snaps, slapping through the oaks and ash, leaves turning their pale sides upwards in defiance. Outside, in the safe shelter of the porch, I wait, expectant, like a Christmas Eve child. I hear the rain now hustling down the west ridge. It will make its way to me as surely as the obligated thunder speaks for the silent lightning. I close my eyes, inhale the sharp scent of raindrops hitting nearby potato hills where wombs of black earth nourish and hold a growing brood. I breathe in the settling smell of 1,000 round drops mixing with the red clay of my dusty rural road. Local cars pass with tinted windows rolled up tight. The first heavy drops fall into the porch rail, ricochet wildly onto my hands and face. On this hot August day, I am anointed by the Alpha and Omega. In this holy moment, I pray that if reincarnation exists, if I am allowed to come back to this planet again, I return as a single, simple raindrop. Oh, the honor to be one of many that watered the daisy plucked by the fingers of an adolescent girl, the flower petals foretelling, he loves me, he loves me not, he loves me. How incredible it would be to fall through the freezing sky, change into a tiny speck of sleet, and land with a six-sided snowflake on the outstretched tongue of a laughing child. Perhaps I could be one of the raindrops sent down to Texas to soothe the drought-thirsty throat of a longhorn cow. Maybe I would wind up in the pure water of a mountain stream and help cool the hooves of the big-eyed doe as she bounds down the run, outwits the hungry wolf. Or the glory to be the sacrificial drop that puts out the last hint of fire from a marching clan man's torch. Oh, that I could live yet again and leave in this magnificent way.
We have to be very aware that what they're trying to do is eliminate these environmental controls. They want to have a total free monopoly of corporate extraction that has massive implications for eroding the kind of law that has come out of popular democracies from below to create these. And people have died for this. They have fought for this for decades.
That's right.
You know, it took so much for them to get to an electoral place. So I realize I'm moving through some periods of time, but I want to emphasize that these elections have been happening from 1998. It was 56% win. Even with 1 year after the Constituent Assembly, again, huge referendum.
And at that point particularly, it was quite liberating for me to actually listen to issues that were presented by the poets, because India was even more regressive. Now we've had some changes in terms of, people who have like different beliefs are accepted more. But at that point, it was even more regressive than it is today. So things like, gay rights or things like, being a transgender would have been like really frowned upon in 2013 in India. But there has been, a lot of legal acceptance and a lot of activism around those things. So now we can talk more about those issues. So that's one of the things that stood out to me at Vancouver Poetry Slam. And I had been to a few sessions while I was there. They were hosting this weekly night. I think it was on Wednesday. So I was there at a few sessions. And
there's ex-lovers out there inhaling those same spots to catch a whiff of my memory. There's some rotting in the ears of a man who first held me when I greeted the world. Maybe my honey was too potent from birth. There's even more rotting in the hands of a man that was meant to be a mentor, but my honey seemed too sticky for him to not want to see just how sticky. Didn't matter that he was closer in age to the man who first took my honey without asking. Why the f*** y'all keep taking my honey without asking?
What?
When did I become the bee and you, I mean, dumb keeper? When did my body start producing honey just to be stored in different places? When did I become so lost in all the noise that the buzzing just started to sound like music? Sweet melodies no one thinks twice about. When did I lose the will to say, you can't have none of my honey? It's my honey. Rather, I may have dropped some along the way, but it wasn't for you. I may have shared it with some not worthy, but that doesn't make it less pure. Shit, I've even shared it with some who didn't even want the honey. They only took it because it was free. Something worth the tasting. A sample or something they might like.
Just like a man who holds doors with power to dominate the hour. Our hours of isolation in a bedroom, a hotel room, a room where someone watched and turned away with nothing to say to me or anyone, no one, everyone.
This is the Listen and Be Heard Hour, brought to you by the Listen and Be Heard Network, and I'm Martha Senator. I failed to mention in this last little segment that we also heard the voice of Demi Devine, Where's My Honey At? And she was recorded by Aranon and during our season 3 of the Listen and Be Heard Hour, when they were performing out in the street and Aranon was playing the saxophone on the occasion of Malcolm X's birthday celebration. And I think there were a lot of other things going on as well. But you can look in our archives at listenandbeheard.net for some of those episodes. The time goes by so quickly here in the Audio Garden, and I'm telling myself that winter is going to go by quickly. And I'm reminding myself that when things seem uncertain is the time to dig in. Dig into the ground as well and plant seeds. And I'm not sure. It might be a little early to plant some seeds in my little kitchen window. But I think I'm going to do it anyway, just to bolster my spirit. I've been making a little bit of compost that's almost ready for some seeds. And I saved the seeds, some of my seeds, from my garden as I moved north. And so it will be an experiment to see which of those seeds can make it in this new climate. But I'm going to try some amaranth because I have tons of it and it's a native seed. And I'm hoping that that means it's going to be happy in New York. And I also saved some okra seeds and sunflower seeds and things. Some of them, it is a little too early to start them. But maybe some peppers and tomatoes. I've got some different things stashed away. And I'm going to pull them out to remind me that seeds can become trees. What about you? What about we? What kind of garden are we all looking forward to having this spring? Here in the Audio Garden, there's always a warm, welcoming place to listen and be heard. I invite you to listen to our sister show, Beyond Borders. All of that is available at listenandbeheard.net. Please consider donating to our efforts to this commercial-free program.
I like to think about it as sobering. Mm-hmm. It's bringing to readers the experience from a farmer's perspective, from people who work the land, from people who actually their livelihood depends on dependable weather. And it's bringing that experience into the reality of all the rest of us who depend on these folks.
Listen and be heard. This is the city work. Get yours while you can. Because don't let nobody fool you on. Blessings to all. Love, peace, and happiness.
Thanks, as always, to Davian Dial at WPVM Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, for introducing Listen and Be Heard to the broadcast airwaves. KCEI in Taos, New Mexico. KEPJ in San Antonio, Texas. KHOI in Ames, Iowa. And KFOI in Red Bluff, California. And other stations that are part of the Pacifica Affiliate Network for cultivating the audio garden in your communities. And our own Listen and Be Heard Network, host of WLBH.org. Please visit us at listenandbeheard.net and sign up for our email newsletter and at our Listen and Be Heard YouTube channel, where you will find unedited video interviews of our featured guests. My name is Martha Senator, and I want to thank you for listening and giving me the opportunity to be heard.
This is the end of the two-month tour we're doing here by bus. We've been about 6,000 miles in the same bus together, so if we say anything strange, it's only because that's the way we feel right at the moment. We've seen about 32,000 Holiday Inns. Only stayed at 20 of them, but yeah. We've seen plenty.
But the main purpose behind the tour is not to travel by bus for 6,000 miles, but to tell people that you have an album out.
Yeah.
Is that right?
We got an album out on Reprise right now called GP, and we're out pushing it.
And that's what the band sounds like. The band sounds like the album.
Yeah.
But you don't sound like the band today. You're going to sound a little bit different.
Oh, yeah.
You can make that clear if you want to.
Well, we're just sitting here in a radio studio with a bunch of guitars on our laps and stuff.
And no band.
Our drummer is sitting in a deck chair.
Yeah.
Decked.
Sunning himself.
Whacking drums.
And it's just Emmy and Norman and I singing. Sorry about that, Indy.
It's okay.
So what are you going to do? You going to do something off the album?
Well, not exactly.
You're not going to do anything off the album.
We couldn't really pretend to do anything off the album without a pedal steel. And
these are the songs. These are bus songs we're going to do.
Yeah, this is
These are songs we sing on the back of the bus.
For our own amusement when we have to sit in the back of the bus.
Or the front.
You can't really hear too well. Well, no, that's right.
The engine's in the back of the bus,
that's
so
right.
We're going to be lacking that sound, too.
Yeah, anybody want to imitate a bus rumble?
Yeah. Let me turn on the air conditioner.
It's a good idea anyway.